15 by now, and this is a very special episode for us today, because I have a guest. I am recording this live with our good friend, the Male Brain, also known as Dawn Pine, coming to us live, well, as of this moment, as of time of recording, from Israel. Welcome, Dawn, and thank you very, very much indeed for appearing on my podcast. I really appreciate it. Take a moment, please, if you could, to introduce yourself and let everybody who's listening know where you're from, what you're about, and you know, we'll take it from there, really.
Okay, thank you for the introduction, and I'm very honored that this is my first podcast ever. So you'll have to excuse me if I'm less familiar with the rules, but in that sense, I'll introduce myself. I'm Dawn Pine. I've written in the Manosphere for Return of Kings. Used to be a part of the Rushdie Forum, but since that forum kind of lost track, so I'm less there. I'm in my late 40s, happily divorced with two teenage daughters. By orientation, I'm a systems engineer. Studied electrical engineering, also have an MBA. And I've worked almost all of my life in Israel. I used to be in the Israeli Defense Forces, and I'm still on reserve duty as major. And currently, I'm a family-owned business. In consulting, I do all sorts of ICT and related aspects of consulting, usually in large scale projects.
Cool, very interesting, and thank you for sharing that with us. Also, I should say thank you, as always, for your excellent contributions to the great Monday DACT browser crashes. The listeners may or may not know. Pretty much like half the stuff that I put out is stuff that comes from Dawn in the form of videos and links, and they're very entertaining, very educational. So it's a lot of fun to put that stuff together. It is time consuming though, and Dawn makes it much easier on me by essentially just kind of sending me stuff to incorporate, which is very, very helpful. So thank you for that. Now, you mentioned, you know, you have teenaged daughters in Israel. I remember reading your work from the days of Return of Kings, where you mentioned how to raise them properly and how to raise daughters properly, what you've seen in the West and in Israel. Walk us through, if you could, some of the things you've seen in terms of the impacts of feminism in Israel and what that's done to Israeli society.
So we actually had a short correspondence on that, and you published me a short writing on that one just a few weeks ago. And what happened is that basically up until the early 70s in Israel, females used to marry young. Young would be age of 21, being a median age. Or an average age for marriage. And my mother, for example, married my father when she was 24, which at that time was not considered late, but was a little bit age-related. She was, I wouldn't say one of the last of her group to marry, but still not the earliest one. And what happened is that during the Israel, as I've written, took some time to incorporate Western type of thinking, both in the good sense or the bad sense. And what happened is that it took some time, and marriage age went up slightly more and more at the time. Today in Israel, it's about 27, I think, or 26. And that means that over the past 40 years, it came up 1 to 2 years every decade. However, what is less considered is that there are more girls not getting married or getting married way later. Israel is still some sort of, let's call it a tribal society in that sense. Even though we have considered now that there's kind of like four tribes in Israel, one being the ultra-Orthodox, mm-hmm. and one being the secular one, which is the, let's call it the larger tribe, and the Arabs and attached to it, and the last one would be, let's call it the all the others, which includes immigrants, Russian-based immigrants, which are not Jews, which kind of comprise the whole thing. Those tribes, most of them are still family-oriented.
Yep.
Which means there's a lot of pressure on females and males alike to get married. If you reach the age of 30-something and you're not married, and you better be in a serious relationship. Otherwise, you get a lot of heat both from your parents and from the environment.
Yes.
So there's the non-parenting types are still available. And they even have, I wouldn't say a good representative, but they have a representation in the media. Mm-hmm. But most of the girls that I've talked to in their 20s or 30s would really much like to be married and have kids. Not in the accessory kind of, let's have kids because it goes well with my new home, but in the sense that I actually want to be a mother, but I still want to have a career and I want a good husband.
Right.
This is the mainstream in Israel, and even if you're a feminist, even a hardcore feminist, most of them would like to get married. They have a different idea of how marriage should be, but Israel as a society is actually very focused and has the still has the tradition of getting married, having kids, and making yourself in the world. Most females would like to work, but I see a lot of them after a few years talking about either not doing a full-time, doing, let's say, an 80% kind of a job, or even being part-time. Being a stay-at-home mom is less of a thing in Israel.
Really?
It used to be the case in the it's the essence of Zionism, let's say, looking back 100 years ago, is that females were part of that struggle. And mm-hmm. they worked and they fought. They should also have babies, but they were part of it. So the ethos is still there. But let's say the same thing that happened after World War II with the baby boomers, where women went off the labor market and wanted to get married, happened with the establishment of the Israeli state.
Right. Interesting. So, I mean, there's a lot of good information there, which I honestly didn't know myself, and touched on a lot of topics. One thing that I found interesting, that as you mentioned, is that the prevalence of women wanting to have careers is much less common in Israel than Jewish populations, liberal Jewish populations in the U.S. I mean, I lived in New York for a long time, and I saw a lot of Jews in New York City. The secular Jews would very much be even ahead of the rest of Western society in terms of careerism and wanting to go to university, get a job, kind of date around in their 20s and only really settle down in their 30s. But it's interesting, you mentioned the ultra-Orthodox crowd in Israel itself. And my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, is that they really are very insular, right? They only keep to themselves. Is that about right?
There are trends in the ultra-Orthodox stream. The ultra-Orthodox currently are about 20% of the population, but their mm-hmm. fertility rate is the highest.
Yep.
The average fertility rate in Israel is about 3 kids per household, and which is the highest in the Western world.
Yep.
But more than that, actually the secular crowd has those 3. The ultra-Orthodox tend to have 4 and above. And yeah. In the next generation, they're going to be more than 20%. They're expected to rise, I think, within either 10 or 15 years to 25 and almost 30% of the population. They also have trends over there of, let's call it, semi-feminism, because based on the political aspect of what happened in Israel about 7 years ago, it's named the status quo, in which some of the ultra-Orthodox Jews don't go to the army, but instead study in yeshivas, mm-hmm. in the religious schools, in order to maintain the learned world, the world of religious education. So what happened is that it used to be something like a few hundreds of people that would be excluded from military service. But the others, but what happened is that currently today we're talking about thousands and sometimes even more than that on a yearly basis. This means that what happened is they have to be in the yeshivas and their wives go to work. So they don't actually develop a career in that, let's call it in the careerist sense, but they need to provide for the house because the man, the husband, goes to the yeshiva, studies the Torah, the religious teachings, gets, let's call it, an allowance from the state in that sense. It's, this is something that a political redistribution of funds.
Yep.
The wife needs also to work because that is not enough for a family of six or a family of eight. Yep. This is the ultra-Orthodox. However, what happened is that during the last 10 years or so, they've started going into high-tech, lower end, for example, QAs or implementations or IT things. And their integration with society became much more extensive because they were kind of guarded in the sense, if you look at the Brooklyn ultra-Orthodox Jews, they put themselves in the ghetto.
Yes.
In that sense. But they have very limited, they have contact with the outside world, but they try to minimize it. This was the case here. Over the past decade or so, actually, I think it's now almost 15 years, they had to go to work. They had to, I wouldn't say drop out, but less attend the yeshivas and more actually go to work and integrate with the larger society. And that trend currently influences them in a semi-feminist way, because girls also need to, the wives also become semi-high-tech in that sense.
Right.
But also the boys, one of the girls I'm dating has an ultra-religious family, and all of her brothers attended yeshiva for a short while, but then went to work. And their wives also work. They do have a lot of children, but they become more, the more you work, the more you integrate with a larger society, that has influence.
Yeah, and that mirrors what I mean, everything you're saying mirrors what I saw in Jewish society in America as well. I remember working alongside Jews, and they're good people. I like them a lot. They're very, very smart. They had lots of kids. I mean, one of them, I think, returned to Israel some time ago. He had he has five kids, maybe more. Another one who's just like fresh out of Yeshiva College in New York was married at the age of like 22, 23, and already had his first kid by the time he was 24. Almost certainly had more kids after that. They were working in finance, in technology consulting and such, and they were very much, you know, integrated into mainstream society, with their own kind of distinct dietary patterns and belief systems and all that. And that's fine. But we also had, there also was that phenomenon, as you described, of these like ultra Orthodox ghettos where you just, you know, as a goyim or as a Gentile, you just don't go in there. It's not possible. So I'm guessing there's something similar in Israel, like where there are certain parts of Israel where you just can't go, right?
You know, you can go, but for example, in Jerusalem, you have the 100 gates or Mea Shearim area, mm-hmm. in which you know that if you enter there on a Saturday or on a Friday evening, I wouldn't say you might not get out, but if you come with the car and not by foot, or if you come with indecent clothing, you can get beaten. It's kind of like you're asking for trouble in that sense. It's their neighbor. Right. It reminds in the worst sense of what happens sometimes in Europe, where you should be dressing according to Sharia law in some areas.
Yes.
The police would go in, but they have an issue because those communities are extremely tight, and they have, I wouldn't say, it's not like they have their own police, but they have their own penalty system, mm-hmm. and they don't tell on their own kind. It has the pros and cons, like everything else, but you can go there, you just don't bother the population and adhere to their dress code.
Yeah. Yeah, makes sense. I wanted to ask you as well about the impact of decollectivization, or at least movement away from the kibbutz and the moshav. When I was in Israel, this was like 5.5 years ago, so August 2014, I actually spent a couple of weeks in Israel at the time. Best trip of my life. I really loved it there. But I went to Sdot Yam Kibbutz and then Gan Shmuel Kibbutz. And I spent a lot of time kind of with the group that I was in, wandering around these places for a number of reasons. And what they told us was that these kibbutzim had gone from very kind of collectivized farming and socialist organization to one particular industry. And has that been your experience as well, or is the kibbutz system still very much alive and well in Israel today?
Well, we need to look first at the overall trend. And the thing is that starting 120 years ago, at the second Aliyah, as it's called, most of them were Russian Jews who believed in socialism of the kind. And
yes.
What happened that even though that more than 80%, I think almost 90% of them actually eventually after coming to Israel migrated back, either to Russia to be part of the communist movement, or even just going to the States or the Europe, they started a very collectivist foundation of healthcare, of government types, labor unions, and so on. And that collectivist mindset was the elite.
And right.
Even though a lot of the crowd coming over to the then pre-established state of Israel was, let's call it, the normal bourgeois, third class, and so on, the elite was more than 10% out of the population, and they were organized. And the collectivist mindset, which actually predated that one, because as everyone knows, and you can look at history, Jews are a very tight community, even though we have our own internal quarrel. There's a saying that where you have two Jews, you'll have three opinions.
Yes.
Yes. But in that collectivist mindset established the state of Israel. And let's say till the beginning of the 1970s was the norm.
Mm-hmm.
And so the kibbutz was a very strong establishment in the 50s where we were a young state. And we actually didn't have much food because the country grew population-wise 4 to 5 times in 10 years due to immigration.
Yep.
So those areas, since they were doing farming mostly, were very strong financially. And that was the, that enabled them to remain collectivist in that sense, even though the society by itself was social democrat, semi-capitalist. But what happened is that during the 1980s, the both the import of American ideas, but also a very harsh financial crisis, hurt them really bad. And they had to kind of deregulate themselves, both from ideology and also economically. So they started to establish industries. And the stronger ones were able to do it faster than the weaker ones. You need to remember that if you lived in the kibbutz, you actually didn't have property. The house that you lived in was not yours. It was the kibbutz's. You didn't have much of a belonging in that sense. You can think about it like an actual communist experiment. In a sense that everyone got what he needed and contributed as he could. That's the Marxist way. But people were very ideologically focused on that one and helping others and maintaining that community and believing that they were the elite looked down on capitalists, even though eventually they had to adapt. That adaptation was very harsh in the 1990s, but following that one, since they also got a government bailout during that time, most of them were able to sustain themselves and retain some of that community sense, but go full capitalist on matters of economy, of property, housing, and so on. Some of them were very successful in that sense that they were able to even do an IPO for that factory or that business. And that profit came back to the kibbutz itself, being a shareholder. So that major trend also took place in, let's call it, in the sphere of Israel. Well, in the 1980s, very slowly the atomization started. Large cities grew. The Tel Aviv, Jerusalem, Haifa grew very much. And people started looking more on how can they help themselves. This was basically the result of the Yom Kippur, the 1973 war trauma for Israel, where you found out that actually your government is incompetent. We all know that's common knowledge, but at that time, people in Israel believed very much in their government and its ability because we had the evidence that it's working. 1967, Six-Day War, the ability to receive migration and grow. And following that trauma and adopting the 1980s American spirit of individualism and let's make money and so on, that slowly weakened the ties between Israelis. We still consider ourselves to be a semi-united community in that sense, but that train has passed.
Right. Yeah. And that mirrors what I'm hearing from some others who have, at random gone back to Israel or spent time there. It does sound as though the spirit of Israel, as forged in the kibbutz and in the process, the very difficult process of creating that nation, has helped stave off a lot of the problems of the modern world. Third wave feminism, nonsense that's come from the West, it's finding it harder to penetrate into Israel, but it's still making some impact. Is that a fair assessment?
It's making an impact. And if you look at the secular Jews, which contribe something like 70% of the population, there's a strong feminist trend in that sense that girls want to succeed and they want to work. But they also, it has its own, let's call it Israeli flavor, in that sense where they want to be successful, they want to go to the army, but not all of them. You don't see a lot of girls, at least the secular ones, who say, well, I want to stay at home and raise my kids.
Yeah.
I do want to have kids. I want to be part of a family and so on. We need to remember that the European and American concept of moving away from your parents' home to a different country or a very far city or state altogether is non-existent in Israel. The longest drive you can have is a six-hour drive tops, and that is traffic from one end to the other, from south to north or vice versa. Most of the people I know live near to their parents, let's say up to an hour or two-hour drive. My folks are like 15 minutes away driving, no traffic. That means that they can see their grandkids. They have influence. You meet over at weekends to some extent. That family orientation helps to push back the, let's call it, the feminist atomization, and also the notion that guys are evil. If you're on your own and you have no one, you're very susceptible to ideology. But being part of a crowd, you follow the crowd, for better or worse, in that sense.
Right. Well, that's very interesting, because that mirrors what I've seen in travels to Eastern Europe. I mean, the funny thing is, like, a lot of people would say that Russian women are gold diggers, or they are much more feminist in Moscow or St. Petersburg than in the rest of Russia, which is actually true. They are. But while women there are, like, similar to Israel, they do want to get a little bit of a solid grounding in the workforce, at least for a little while, they are also very focused on having a family and kids. And it's very different. It's a very, very different world from what it's like in Western Europe, where women are expected and even required to work, and they have that expectation put on them, you know, to the point where guys in Western Europe are like, friends and wives to work, which you know, makes no sense in Eastern Europe. And it sounds like while that possibility is open to women in Israel, it's not a demand. It's not it's something that they kind of want for themselves rather than something that's imposed on them. Is that right?
They want from themselves, but also from an economic perspective, they have to, in order to raise family. It's very uncommon that there's only one income household, even if the other is minimum wage, they need to work.
Yeah, that makes sense. So with respect to what you mentioned earlier about the melding together of Israeli society, that I'm sure has been a very difficult process at times, what with the large waves of immigration of Jews returning to Israel itself. What effect has that had on Israel's government system? And the reason I ask that is because, from what I've been able to see, Israeli domestic politics is really complicated, very messy. It seems to be extremely difficult to form any kind of government between all the various parties. And, you know, this leads on to what's happening in Israel right now, politically speaking. So what's your take on that situation?
So I'm going to go back to the sentence I said yesterday, which is a centuries old one, that in a place you have two Jews, you're going to have three opinions.
Yeah.
And the thing is that Israel, as if you look at it politically, there's a left, right, and center. But the boundaries are very shaky and very blurry on those.
Mm-hmm.
And usually if you look back for a long time, usually the center kind of dominates. And if you're a right wing or a left wing major party, you usually try to become more centralized in order to gain much more of the votes. The problem is that it actually started in the 1950s, where the center left dominated Israel for about 30 years since the establishment. And what they did is they actually boycotted the right in a way that David Ben-Gurion, the first prime minister, used to call the opposition leader the guy sitting next to that guy. In a sense, he wouldn't mention his name. It was that harsh. Right. And that kind of created, he talked a little bit about the melting pot of Israel, of different immigration. That kind of was able politically to put the lid for a few years, but then it kind of erupted. So you have a lot of forces believing that they're victims in that sense, historically, long ago or short time ago. And since people have very strong opinions on that, they have sometimes a hard time to come to terms with the other side.
Right.
Even the you look at, for example, Kahol Levan, Blue and White, the center-left new party, and the Likud, the right-wing center party, they don't have much of an ideologist chasm between them. Their opinions are very much the same. And it's very surprising, if you look at it, it should be very surprising to see why not make a coalition. Those are two very large parties. They can make a coalition and rule, and usually it comes down to people.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're power hungry, as you should be as a politician, you don't want to share your power that much. And this actually happened to us in the 1980s, where there were trouble putting together a coalition. Eventually it worked out, but in the last year, we're going to have three elections the same year with the same outcomes.
Yep.
Because the two elections that were 5 months apart were the same. It was the same outcome. There was a little change in party structure and numbers, but that was it. It was a very little change.
Yep.
And basically, or hopefully, they need to come to terms with that and see if they can work together or form a coalition. The main problem, we used to laugh at that and say it's like a Hungarian cube.
Yep.
Hungarian Rubik's cube. Because no one can figure it out, but there's a Russian standing by which can finish the whole thing in like 20 to 30 seconds. This is a Viktor Lieberman. He's head of a right-wing party, which got something like 10% of the vote, almost 10% of the votes. And if he would have gone with either one of the big parties, there would be a coalition. But he decided to stall, get more power. That ended up in having the third election term.
Yes, yes, that's coming up. I mean, I'm not sure when, but
in almost a month and a few days. Yeah.
Wow, I mean, three elections in the space of 1 year. That's crazy. Yeah.
We're having jokes now about that you can that they're looking for an election committee representative for a full time job.
Yeah, and it would be a good position too. Given the frequency, is there any ground to the charges level that the current prime minister Benjamin Netanyahu? I can't remember if it was you who sent me this or if I read it on Breitbart, but it was something like, it was an article to the effect that there is a kind of like Israel has its own deep state coup ongoing against its sitting prime minister because he represents everything that the kind of the left liberal elite can't stand. Now, I don't know. I mean, I thought it was an interesting argument, but what's your take on that?
So, first of all, this is an opinion. There's the idea behind deep state actually runs the thing that goes that Trump is going through, as Netanyahu has been going through for years. Here's the first. This is a fact. This is not an opinion. This is actually a fact. But the thing is that the deep at the time of the establishment of the state of Israel, everything was intertwined. There was no separation of authorities in that sense. Mm-hmm. And even if you look at the parliamentary system of Israel, the legislative actually makes the executive branch.
Right.
Because if you have a majority in the legislative parliament, in the Knesset, then you become the executive branch. The separation is not that good.
Yeah.
And at the time, for 25 years or so, it was you scratch my back, I scratch your back, in an ideological sense. You would appoint to judge's position, to executive branch position, people of your own kind from your own party. This was very accepted. The thing is that unlike the states, where if a new president comes in, and he changes the ministries, and everyone has to go home, and you got thousands of people leaving DC, and thousands of people coming in. That's not the case in Israel. They have tenure. They have tenure. You can change the general manager of a ministry, but it's vice presidency. You cannot. The executive branch has tenure and cannot be removed.
Mm-hmm.
So what happened is that. Till the 1970s, it was the same party that appointed all those people in the executive branch and in the legislative branch and judicial branch. But then what happened is that in 1977, the right took power, but its leader, Menachem Begin, thought that just by leading the executive branch and the legislative branch, just by being the leaders there, you don't need to do anything, and people will align to it. And
right.
He was wrong. And what happened is that for years, that issue was neglected. So a kind of a deep state, not in the deep state sense of the U.S., but let's call it a deep state would be a good understanding of it, developed. Meaning that mm-hmm. judges appointed judges, and since those judges were center-left oriented, they appointed their own kind. The same happened in the executive branch, and it became more diverse. You got more right-wing people there, but still there's a majority of it also in the academy, in the executive branch, in the judicial branch of, let's call it, left-wing elite.
Mm-hmm.
They take care of their own the same way that people take care of their own.
Yeah.
So everywhere. this is the deep state that happens. Although the powers in Israel are more respected. If you're the prime minister, you're more respected, and people do as you tell them. But the flavor of it would be not that much. Now, what happened with Benjamin Netanyahu? I recently read a very interesting article, and it theorized that since after the murder of Prime Minister Rabin in 1955, in 1996, the election was lost to the center-left parties, and Benjamin Netanyahu took power, they look at him, and it's kind of like he's the devil. He's the guy that took the power from us. So he became the way that Trump is the obsession of the left wing or the Democrats in the States. Netanyahu is the obsession of the left wing or the opposition in Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1999, by the way, he was removed from power via election. But in the last 10 years, since he became prime minister, he is winning election terms right up, one after the other. And that makes some of the people crazy. They cannot understand how it is, the same way you put the blue collar video about the CNN guys making fun of the right wing people who voted for Trump.
Exactly.
You just don't get it. And my mother, by the way, being second wave feminist in that sense, and left leaning voter for decades, cannot understand why people would vote for him.
Yes.
Yeah. And I tell her, look, he's not, I never voted for his party, but then look, I tell her, look, it's that simple. He actually brings something to the table, which these guys, yes. which resonate with other people. And he does things. You cannot say that he's doing all bad. That's not
yes.
true. And she says, she agrees to me with me to some extent, but said they should know better. So it's
yes.
like, you have a very strong opinion, so everyone should somehow adhere to your opinion because this is the right one.
Yes.
And what happened is that since it failed to remove him with in the elections, so let's try the equivalent of impeachment.
Mm.
If you're doing something, you're going to sometimes make mistakes. Sometimes those mistakes might be even legal mistakes. So if someone recognizes such a mistake or believes that there's been a legal misconduct, he says, okay, he's a prime minister. He cannot do that. So mm-hmm. we need to go after him. Now, it is the first time in a long time. He had a lot of cases open and against him, but it's the first time it comes to court.
Mm.
I don't know. Usually in the justice world, you know that people are presumed innocent until proven otherwise.
Yep.
It's in politics, you presume guilty until proven innocent. Even in that case, it doesn't happen.
Yes, exactly. And that does seem to be the case, you know, from everything that I'm reading. Granted, you know, my reading into the subject is mostly from kind of alternative media sources such as Breitbart or Russia Today or the Daily Mail, which is not really an alternative. But, I mean, it's very much non-standard media. And it is the same situation over and over and over again. I mean, whether it's Trump in the U.S. or Netanyahu in Israel or Prime Minister Modi in India, you get the same exact reactions. And it is always this reaction of the people should have known better. What, you know, why were they voting for somebody who's so clearly crazy? Why would they not take the enlightened view and vote for the good left liberal? And you know, I've had this exact same argument with people. It's like, you can't tell people what to think if they've been ignored and marginalized for so long. Of course, they're going to react. What do you expect? You know.
So in 1977, after the Likud right wing party took power, some of the left wing ideologists in Israel said that it's time to replace the people.
Mm-hmm.
There was an actual saying like that of a guy named Ben Aharon, who was a left-wing ideology. He says the people failed in voting. This is
yes.
when you have a very strong sense and very strong thought of what is right. If someone disagrees with you, it's like he's a baby. He doesn't know what he's doing.
Yes.
And that sense exists within some of the left-wing people in Israel, who say, well, you know, they're voting, the right-wing voters vote against their own interests. They're brainwashed
yep.
or something.
Yep.
And they just can't understand how could it be that people would vote like that since they know. It's not that they feel or think, they know it.
Yes, they know it as a certainty. I mean, They've seen, you know, in the last, it's remarkable, in the last 5 years, they've watched every single one of their most cherished beliefs come under sustained attack. I mean, with Trump in the US, with Brexit in the UK, which, you know, thank heaven is finally done. I saw it repeatedly. I remember having conversations with people when I was in London in 2014, and you know, one, I was just sitting doing my work and a colleague behind me, he's a Chinese guy, you know, born and raised in the UK. And he asked me what I thought of the European Union. And, you know, I tried to keep politics out of things, but he kept pushing it. So I was like, well, I think the EU is terrible for Britain, and I expect the UK to leave eventually. And I think that the European project is a terrible failure. And he was shocked. He couldn't believe what I was saying. And, you know, time, of course, has since proven which argument was right. But what is interesting, and it seems to be repeating around the world, in Israel, in India, in the UK, in the US, everywhere, is this horror that the elites have, that the people would dare to defy their will, that they would dare to vote for something different. And it is remarkable how consistent that is. It is, I think, as you said, it's a mindset that they genuinely believe that they have the right to tell the rest of us what to think.
Since you, if you know what's right and you have an understanding of the truth, it's like a believer. You know what the right belief is. So everyone is all either a heretic and should be killed, or he's an infant and doesn't understand what he's doing and needs to be told what to do.
Yes.
And yes, by which way, is a very... I would say that some of the right wings are not cleared from that type of belief.
True. That's very true. It affects both sides of the debate. I don't contest that at all. It's from what I've seen, it's definitely the left that exhibits it the most. There are definitely voices on the right that have the same problem.
And usually in Israel, it comes from the religious sector, where they say that the secular people are just, they call it captive babies. Mm. Their mind was captured by someone else, and since they're Jews, hopefully, eventually, they will come to their senses and understand the true meaning and adhere to the true belief system that should be.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Which is, you know, the danger of dogma, no matter where you go. I wanted to ask you, actually, about the perception that Israelis have of America and Americans. And the reason I ask that is because when I was there, the impression that I got was that Israelis generally have a reasonably positive view of the U.S. But you and I have discussed this privately, you know, in emails and in blog comments as well, where you said that Israelis understand that the U.S., that they kind of depend on the U.S. in a lot of ways, and it worries them because they can see on the ground the situation as it is rather than the way Washington sees it. And they're not entirely comfortable with being so tightly chained to the U.S. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, what happened, we need to go back. And during the 1950s, when Israel was a very new nation and didn't have a strong ally, and only in 1956, it allied itself with France. And that was until 1967. There's a major trauma that just before the 6 days war, France removed its alliance with Israel and kind of left us hanging. And the U.S. came in as a strong ally since 1968. And you see that there from even ideological standpoint, but also from, as you said, feet on the ground, there was a saying in the World War II that Britain is the unsinkable, aircraft carrier for the States. So Israel, in that sense, is the unsinkable aircraft carrier for the U.S., although the U.S. Decided long ago, since the 1970s, to less interfere directly in the Middle East. Even though there's a lot of voices about going to Syria and so on, and Iraq, those are the exception to the rules. And what happened is that Israel was very much dependent on the U.S. in the 1970s and then again in the 80s. And what happened in the 1990s with Clinton is, since we had the agreement with the Palestinian Authority, the American contributed as part of the rebuilding of army bases at the West Bank. Mm-hmm. And that dependency stayed. But what happened is that at the time we received both military aid and civilian aid, and the civilian aid was reduced to zero, which was a good idea. Right. Now, what people usually don't understand about aid is that you don't actually get money. What you get is a credit line in the States where you have to buy U.S. goods and specific ones, meaning it's not just like you have an allowance from your parents and you could do whatever you want with the money. You have store credit. So that it's like the U.S. paying the industrial military complex money for other nations.
Mm.
This is what the actual aid is about in the case of Israel. Now, this money is used for airplanes, guns, but also IT and communication and every type and other types of equipment and tanks and so on, according to what the Israeli army decides to procure.
Yep.
The thing is that people understand after the Obama administration that it could be the case where even though you don't see eye to eye and you become limited in the international way, but also military wise, because an attack on Iran was, I wouldn't say impossible, but very hard to pull off under the Obama administration.
Yep.
Everyone wants to be able to maneuver as much as possible. And this is, by the way, a good thing that Netanyahu did. He reduced the dependency between Israel and the state to some extent. But we still need a superpower on our side, because Israel is maybe the only nation in the world where other nations actually declare and do things in order to destroy it. So
yes.
we do need support. We do need some sort of protection. However, there was a crazy idea in Israel. Let's do a defense pact with the United States that if we're attacked, they come to our aid.
Yeah.
This is, I wouldn't say a hallucination, but it's a nightmare, because in that sense, you'll have to define what is attack and when you're actually being attacked. And since we get missiles on a daily or a weekly basis from Gaza Strip, or terror attacks, some extent, in some cases, what are you going to do about it? If you're in such a defense pack, you won't have maneuverability, the ability to choose what type of response you're going to do. Maybe kind of like 2009, a kind of break the rules thing. Or a smaller one, like sometimes just, you know, bombing something or going after a specific person.
Right.
That dependency will stay, but Israelis understand that we want to enjoy the benefit of it, but not the cons or the price associated with it. And Trump's state of mind of let the proxies do what the proxies do and let's not be involved in it suits us very well in that sense.
Right.
We want to be aligned with the states, not to interfere with the American policy, but have our own maneuverability in that. That works fine. Next president, if it's not Trump, probably will keep that to some extent. But again, to some extent.
Yeah.
So I think that moving forward, looking into the next few years, the dependency on the states would not go away. It's still there. I'm not sure how much it will be reduced. That's very tricky.
Yeah.
But
does make sense.
I think my thought, and there are some people, it's not the majority, it's a tiny minority, saying that if we reduce the military aid by 10% every year, we can get it done within a decade, and then everyone's going to be happy. Because we will be adjusted to not having that aid. And the voice is saying, well, you know, we give them money. They should do what we tell them to do. We need to shut up.
Yes.
But being a tiny minority in the sense, I don't see it happening.
Yeah. No, that makes a lot of sense because, in the U.S., there are voices, increasingly loud number of voices, basically saying, why is the U.S. spending so much of its money and treasure defending Israel when Israel is plainly fully capable of defending itself? And from what you're saying, there are voices, maybe not a majority, certainly, but there are voices in Israel saying, you know what, it's not good for us to be tied down to a superpower, and they should not be dictating policy to us, and we should not be dictating policy to them. So it's interesting to see the reflection on both sides of this kind of point of view. And, you know, speaking of U.S. To Israel, the email which sparked off the possibility of this podcast was actually about, of course, the F-35, which I've...
The flying piano, as you call it.
A complete flying turkey. I can't believe how bad that plane is. But there was a mission sometime last year, from what I heard, of an Israeli F-35 actually penetrating deep into Iranian airspace, not being detected at all, and gathering quite a bit of good intelligence and then getting out again, which led to the sacking of their Air Force chief, basically. Is it fair to say that whatever aid the U.S. gives you guys in terms of weapons systems or fighter aircraft or whatever, Israel has the ability and regularly does, in fact, make them better? It has the ability to make them better and does, in fact, go about actually making them functional, working. Is you guys modify your weapons, is that correct?
This has been a common practice for the last 40-plus years. Yeah. And the thing is that American aircrafts are designed for the U.S. Navy, military, Air Force, whatever. It's not designed for Israel. The last time we designed an aircraft, that was in the 1980s, but then it got canceled, and for good reasons. This was a strike aircraft name is Lavi. Lavi is a Hebrew name for lion. And that was a striking aircraft that was supposed to be kind of like an F-16 type. But that program got canceled. And again, I said for good reasons. The thing is that once you get those planes over here, we need to adjust them. It's specialized avionics. It's radar jamming capabilities. It's added stealth capabilities. It's how you interact with them communication-wise. All those things are part of the norm with the Israeli Air Force for the last almost 40 years now. And it's the same. Even if you buy actual bombs, then you sometimes change the fuse or you change the communication on them.
Right.
To that extent, of course, if you're buying a tank, then the ground forces will change the communication equipment, will not change the engine, but would change the way that you drive it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. And from what I gather, there was a lot of work done as well on developing Israel's own defense industries to the point now where, like, active protection systems and projectile defense systems such as the Iron Dome are kind of being exported to other countries. In fact, since you're in Israel, would you mind just telling us about what kind of a difference the Iron Dome has made and what the successor systems are potentially going to look like?
The idea behind Iron Dome is that since you're being attacked regularly by missiles, rockets, and so on, then let's not let's try to defend from it and as cheap as possible.
Mm-hmm.
The idea behind it is let's have a kind of a projectile which is a type of a missile, but a very cheap one, with a very sophisticated guidance system on the ground, which will decide based on a radar analysis, where is that rocket coming from Gaza going to? Is it going to an actual city? Is it going to land in a field? Because you don't know, but based on physics and wind, you know very well within a few meter thing where it's going to land. And based on that, let's launch something against it and blow it out of the sky.
Yep.
That took something like less than 2 years to develop, which is very fast.
Very fast indeed.
Yes. And the main thing behind it is it comes back to maneuverability. If your city is going to be hit with a rocket, now you have to act. There's no question about it. You have to go on a military offense. But if you contain it and have a good defense, then you don't have to go to war.
Yep.
That increases the executive branch's maneuverability, both politically and internationally. And there was a decision in the 1990s that because the Israeli Defense Forces don't have all that money just to buy from Israeli industries, the Israeli industries needs to go abroad and sell their solutions after being field proven by the IDF in the global market. That made Israel one of the largest manufacturers of weapon systems of any kind. Less platform, but more systems and aided ones. And you have a very large industry of a few thousand companies, starting from just counselors, all the way up to the Israeli air industries and Rafael and Elbit, being global brands selling across the globe. That's the ecosystem, and it's something like, I think something like 10 billion shekels annually last year, which is something like just under $3 billion.
Yep. Yeah, so it's a big part of Israel's economy, and obviously, from what I've seen of Israeli arms, munitions that have been sold overseas, they are very much, well-engineered weapons. One of the things that I was talking about with another one of my readers, we were discussing this for a while, was how over-engineered a lot of American weapon systems are. I mean, they're very good, very useful, very deadly, but they're so over-engineered, the Americans basically come up with this like finely tuned, beautifully calibrated, precision designed, machine drilled golf club to deliver a specific impact on a specific. That's fine and all, but it's like sometimes you just need a baseball bat, and that's perfectly useful, or just a plank of wood to go hit something. Whereas with Israel, at least from what I've seen, the weapon systems are much more purpose built. They're like the Merkava tank and whatever arms that I've seen, the Tavor assault rifle, all of these things are designed for specific purposes and specific uses, and are just designed to work, in the field, no matter what.
Well, I'll have to slightly disagree with you on that, because there's a good saying that the enemy of the good is the best, or the better. And from my experience, a lot of development projects actually fail due to over-specification.
Mm.
And that is the case not only in the civilian market, but also in the military side. The thing is that usually what survive are those purpose-based or custom-built things, but they're also I've seen, for example, on the ICT side, a lot of over-specified projects which work less well. That is correct, that usually in the platform arena, the better platform is the one suited for its purposes. And for example, we don't have aircraft carriers. We don't need that. And we don't need a lot of type of jet fighters, because you need air superiority and you need strike fighters and maybe and carrier ones and helicopters, and that's it. So from that perspective, the landscape here is a little bit simple than in the States, because if you're now in the U.S., you can think, well, I'm going to fight in Russia, but I may be in Africa or in the Middle East or fighting China. Mm-hmm. The range of thing to address is incomprehensible in that sense. So
yes,
this is probably one of the good reasons why you find such platforms which are kind of an all-purpose thing. This is a bad decision to make on a development scale, but you understand where that mindset is coming from.
Oh, that's true. You do get that. I mean, the problem with the F-35 is exactly that it was designed to do everything all at once, and was designed to be kind of this complementary part of the high-low mix. You know, the one super-duper whiz-bang expensive plane, the F-22, to maintain air superiority, and then the F-35 to do everything else. But in the process, you know, they just made so many bad design decisions with it. It's just, it's shocking.
That's
I mean, yeah, they had to, unfortunately, to some extent. But at least one country can get the F-35 up and flying, which is Israel. So that is that is nice to see, I suppose. We're actually over an hour now, but you know, there's been a really good conversation, and I did want to leave off with one final question about, with respect to the geopolitical situation, the recent strikes in Syria last year, and now with the drone strike against Qasem Soleimani in Iran, you know, actually in Iraq technically. How has that affected the situation for Israel in general? And what's the feeling like in Israel about what's going to happen next? Is there fear? Is there worry? Or what? How do Israelis think of the situation at the moment?
There's constant worries after about 1,800 years of being on your toes, looking at that's... That's a common situation, but most Israelis look at it and say, well, you know, there could be a war. We're not sure. We do trust the IDF to handle that. And since a lot of them are also part of that, the escalation to war is very quick and it's, you cannot foresee it. You know when it happens afterwards. I mean, 2006, no one thought that just because three soldiers were killed and taken in the Lebanese border, there would be a 2-month war.
Mm-hmm.
Those things tend to escalate kind of on their own. People hope that there won't be a war, at least most of us. But we basically have no idea. We don't know if there's going to be anything. From my experience, you at least once a decade have some sort of war/operation. So we're now entering a new decade. So I expect there to be at least one in the time frame between now and 2030. There's going to be at least one or two major operations or a war in the classical sense.
Yeah.
But it's going to be more of a rocket thing on our cities more than anything.
Yeah. Right. So on that subject, actually, what is the feeling like about Iran's nuclear ambitions right now? Because that has always been a subject of contention with respect to Obama's Iran deal, which we're not going to do this. And Soleimani was kind of a linchpin of that. And you sent me an article, which will be featuring in Monday's post, Monday's compilation, about this very subject, about how Obama kind of made Soleimani his linchpin of his deal, and Trump just said, screw that, we're not going to do this. Is there, how real is the fear of Iran getting a nuclear weapon and what that means for Israel as a nation?
There's real fear, but there's nothing much to do about it. I mean, not a lot. Mm. If you remember the Stuxnet issue, that was something that really helped push back that that operation. But, you know, if someone has his mind set on something, it's very hard to dissuade him from not doing that.
Yep.
Now, here's the thing, that since 1979, the Iranian regime says back and forth that it wants to destroy the state of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And we're, you know, that the great devil is the United States, but the small devil is Israel. Mm-hmm. And the way you treat the devil is you want to eradicate him. And
yep.
This is what has been going on, both verbally, but to some extent, again, with proxies on the ground physically.
Mm-hmm.
So having a nuclear capability, at the time we used to fear the Syrian chemical capabilities, and they did have one, but they didn't use it because mm-hmm. Syria has a border with Israel. Iran does not. It's a faraway country. They can do it as a terrorist attack. I mean, think about having a nuclear device in New York or in London or in Paris. It's kind of the same thing. You get tens of thousands of casualties and hundreds of thousands of people hurt, sick, wounded, radiated. That thing is the reason that Prime Minister Netanyahu have been on it for the past decade, the whole time. Even trying to go against Obama head to head in the Congress, not to get that deal approved, which eventually failed. But we have no idea what's going to happen. That regime usually sticks by his words.
Yes. Yeah, good point. Sort of wrap things up on that note, but I did want to ask you as well about any projects that you have in mind, and you kind of your personal situation now that Return of Kings is basically more or less closed down. How are you, like, are you looking to get your views about the red pill, about feminism, and about life in Israel out there? And if so, what form would those take? And is this something you're looking to launch or something you're looking to produce in the near future?
Well, I've been thinking about it since the time I've started writing for Return of Kings. Some of the comments that I got directly were, well, I would love to read your blog. And my response would be, well, I don't have one, but if I'll have, it has to be in Hebrew. There's a lot of Manosphering crowd in English, you being one of them. And let's say in that sense, giving the Israeli perspective, even though Israel is in the news, I don't believe there's much of an interest, even though maybe my voice itself. Both of us are more or less echoing other people with our own flavor and with our own life. The thing is, I've been thinking about it, of launching a blog in Hebrew. Here in Israel, there's only one that I know in Israel, which is not that active, which highlights Manosphere tributes and ideas. And it's from a guy who called himself Prime Alpha, but he hasn't been active since 2018. So there's a lot of space here in Israel. If I do it, I won't do it for money. But as I've written, being a divorced father of two, the problem of doxing keeps me occupied in that sense, because I do have something to lose. I'm not sure if I opened it, but if so, I've already written some materials for that, and I think something like 10 to 15 blog posts ready and available. Mm-hmm. This is something usually that would take me a little bit a while to sit on, and eventually I think it will come out, but I just need to see how. I'm not sure if it's going to be in the near future. The last year I've been very preoccupied with kind of the after launch of my own consulting services. So that took a lot of my time. And, of course, my dating life also takes a considerable amount of time.
Of course.
But since that material is available, I do believe it will come out, but it will be in Hebrew for sure.
Yep. Yeah, makes sense. Well, I, for one, certainly wish you all the best with that. Mm-hmm. And, of course, you know, your contributions to my blog have been really greatly appreciated. I'm actually still way behind on some of the links. I might want to take a look at this and write blog posts about it. So I'll get to it eventually. It's just I'm not as productive as I'd like to be. But, go ahead.
We have our priorities, of course.
Yeah, exactly. So life always gets in the way. But a very great pleasure. So I really want to thank you very much for joining me for this podcast. This is the very first guest that I've ever had, and very early on into my podcasting, shall we say. So many thanks to you, Dawn Pine, for your contributions. Please, if you're listening to this, feel free to like, and if you're not subscribed already, please make sure you hit the subscribe button either here on SoundCloud or for regular blog posts. And you can see Dawn's contributions to the blog pretty much every week on Mondays and throughout the week as and when time permits. This is Didactic Mind, episode 4. I've been very privileged to have Dawn Pine as a guest, the male brain, and I will see you on the next one.